You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, engineers create a temporal cloak in which to hide events in time.
And in our case, it's like a history eraser, essentially. We haven't allowed it to happen so that it appears that even though somebody was trying to send information, it appears no information was sent.
Lee Smolin explains why most physicists are wrong to think time is an illusion.
If laws evolve in time rather than time emerge from law, then time has to be more fundamental than law. The time has to exist at a deeper level than even the laws of nature exist.
Loop quantum gravity takes the singularity out of black holes.
As one plunges into the black hole, curvatures start to become large, but at some point then curvatures start to decrease.
And laser experiments entangle two photons that never existed at the same time.
What happens when I measure the last particle, the way I describe particle one has to change now, but particle one doesn't exist anymore.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
Welcome to the new edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. As usual, I don't even know why I bother.
Brendan, are you okay?
I just think to myself, what's the point of doing these shows? Is anybody listening? Sometimes I feel like...
Like the podcast is trapped in a hole carved out of time, so that no matter what we say or do, our words have been edited out of history and nobody else in the universe will ever be able to find any trace of them?
Yeah, I guess that's a bit more elaborate than I was thinking. But it's not like it's actually possible to cloak events in time.
Well, funnily enough, it is possible. Kind of.
A couple of years ago, physicists proposed that it may be possible to develop a space-time cloak that hides events from outside observers. Since then, engineers have been using lasers to create gaps in a stream of light in which to hide secret optical data. Joseph Lukens at Purdue University in Indiana and his colleagues have just developed a cloak that can shroud data sent at 12.7 gigabits per second, more or less the same rate at which data is transmitted through optical fibers in telecommunication systems. The work was published in the journal Nature, and Lukens told me all about how and why his team set about making their temporal cloak.
I think it's kind of an interesting experiment in that if, say, one is communicating in the standard telecommunications way, it's an interesting idea in that our cloak makes it look like no data is being transmitted whatsoever. So in a sense, it's sort of a higher level of cloaking in that not only do we not see the data, but we don't even know the data is being transmitted.
Right.
So we think that's kind of an interesting aspect in that when our cloak is on, it looks as though nobody's trying to send data at all, when in fact they are. And so we think that could be interesting down the road.
How do you create, I guess, this sort of gap in time where you can kind of say things that you want and nobody will notice?
Yeah, in our case, we use the Talbot effect, which has not been applied to this area before. And the spatial Talbot effect is perhaps more well known. I believe it was discovered in 1836. And when you have a wave that's incident on, say, like a diffraction grating or something that separates the frequency components, you can get quite interesting interference patterns away from this grating. In fact, the Talbot effect phenomenon describes how at discrete distances away from this grating, you'll get repetitions of the interference pattern. So it repeats itself. And in fact, they call the interference patterns like Talbot carpets, because a lot of times you can get, you know, very kind of exotic Persian rug looking type interference patterns. And so that's what happens in space. Now, using this idea of space-time duality, which means that under two different approximations to the wave equation, one in space and one in time, you can actually get a one-to-one correspondence in the variables so that what you do in space, you can do in time. And so we do a similar thing in time. We have a phase modulator, which is a component used in telecommunications that sort of acts as our grating, I guess. It has an optical input and an optical output, so you send a laser through it, and it's usually connected with fiber on either end. But it also has an electrical input as well. And depending on the voltage you apply across the modulator, you can change the refractive index of the material. So we send in an electrical signal that oscillates and changes this refractive index at a very fast rate. And this has the effect of changing the timing of the beam going through. And in this case, when we propagate it through a fractional Talbot distance, so the full Talbot distance is where the repetition occurs, and we actually look at a quarter of that. And the idea is that because the frequency components propagate at different speeds, at this particular distance, essentially these components at certain points in time, they cancel each other to get zeros, you know, no energy. And at different points, we maybe will get similar effects, but we don't get perfect cancellation where we have, you know, this hole in time where there's no energy.
And so these are the holes that you're now exploiting.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So what do you do next?
Then we use what's called time lensing. And this is actually another phase modulator, but it functions a little bit differently. In this case, what we do there is take these pulses that we've created and then compress them like you would focus a beam in space. So, you know, you have a beam and you put a lens and you focus down to a small point. That's essentially what we're doing next is we already have these holes in time, but we'd like to make them bigger so that we get a wider cloaking region. Then we can focus the beam down to a very small point where we have wide regions where there's no intensity, so that any time an event occurs in those regions, it doesn't interact with the light, so it's not detected. And then we can undo everything that we did, so that the second half of the picture is just undoing what we did by going through the fiber with the opposite sign of dispersion, which just means that if in one fiber red light goes faster than blue light, then in the next fiber we have red light go slower than blue light. So we can open up a gap by spreading out these frequency components, then close it back up by going through a medium that has the opposite properties. And that's what we do. And as long as whatever it is lands within those regions where essentially have zero intensity, we have no light, no matter what the event is, as long as it occurs there, it won't be detected.
How would, say that I'm trying to transmit a secret message to you,
mm-hmm.
How would you actually pick up the message on the other side? Because it seems like it would be hidden so well, it wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't see anything on the other side at all. You'd
yes.
just see the kind of the background noise going through.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, how we implemented it here, that would be the case. The data is essentially erased from history, I would say. It's not going to be recovered doing anything else later. We can't do some special code or something that will show that the data was actually there. So I think in the first theoretical paper about cloaking, they phrased it a space-time cloak or a history editor. And in our case, it's like a history eraser, essentially. We can't get it back after that point, but I would say we've erased it. We haven't allowed it to happen so that it appears that even though somebody was trying to send information, it appears no information was sent.
Why would we want to do that?
Well, I could envision if someone was trying to send in their own probe laser to sort of pick up our information, we could also make them think we're not sending information, even though we are, by cloaking them. So, you know, depending on if you view the eavesdropper as the one putting up the cloak or if you're viewing putting up the cloak to prevent eavesdropping, either way, you're preventing someone from seeing the data who hopefully shouldn't see the data in the first place. I guess we can't say immediately that this is ready to be put in the ground and used in actual real-world links, but we believe that the technology that we've used definitely integrates well with existing communication infrastructure, and we think there could be applications down the road using this perhaps for secure communications. We feel we have applications-ready technology, but there's still some work maybe before we say, well, you know, here's the prototype, you know, mass-produce it.
Thank you to Joseph Lukens for talking time cloaks with Zia there. If you visit the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find a link to their Nature paper. You'll also find a link to a story Zia wrote for Nature's news website, which explains more about how the cloak could help data transmission through optical fibers.
If you like hearing about those laser experiments, then please stay tuned, because we've got an even stranger quantum test coming up soon. This also reminds me of the Nature of Time essay contest that we ran a few years ago. You can go back and read all the entries on the website, www.fqxi.org/community/essay.
Or if you're not in a time warp, you can visit the same page and read and vote on the essays in this year's essay contest, It From Bit or Bit From It. But it's true. Questions about the nature of time just never end. Does time exist? Physicist Lee Smolin at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, won an FQXI grant a few years ago to think about this question and what the answer may mean for our understanding of the fundamental laws that govern the origin of the universe. Smolin's now written a new book on the subject called Time Reborn, as he explained to reporter Karin Pikama. In it, he explains why he is a firm believer that time is real, even though many physicists think the opposite.
What is time? This deceptively simple question is the single most important problem facing science as we probe more deeply into the fundamentals of the universe. All of the mysteries physicists and cosmologists face, from the Big Bang to the future of the universe, from the puzzles of quantum physics to the unification of the forces and particles, come down to the nature of time. Time is the most pervasive aspect of our everyday experience. Everything we think, feel, or do reminds us of its existence. We perceive the world as a flow of moments that make up our life. But physicists and philosophers alike have long told us, and many people think, that time is the ultimate illusion. I used to believe in the essential unreality of time. Indeed, I went into physics because, as an adolescent, I yearned to exchange the time-bound human world, which I saw as ugly and inhospitable, for a world of pure, timeless truth. Later in life, I discovered that it was pretty nice to be human, and the need for transcendent escape faded. More to the point, I no longer believe that time is unreal. In fact, I have swung to the opposite view. Not only is time real, but nothing we know or experience gets closer to the heart of nature than the reality of time.
That was an excerpt from the book Time Reborn by theoretical physicist Lee Smolin. Smolin, who is a founding and senior faculty member of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo in Canada, was a strong proponent of the idea that time is not real, like most physicists. Until recently, that is. His research has led him to conclude that time is in fact very real. In this new book, published in April 2013, he gently takes the reader through the reasoning for this highly controversial new idea of time. I called him up to find out why he has changed his mind and what this could mean, particularly for our attempts of understanding the universe and the laws that govern it. Just to set the scene for why his theory is so extraordinary, he explains why most physicists currently argue that time is not real, but is just another dimension in our universe, like space.
There is a dominant view, which is that the experience that we have of time passing and of it being always some present moment which passes over to the next present moment is an illusion. And that reality, at this most fundamental level, if you penetrate behind the so-called veil of appearances down to the most fundamental level, you get a picture of reality which is timeless, in which what's really true and what's really fundamental doesn't change in time, but is absolute and doesn't have any variation or change in time.
Smolin refers to ideas on the unreality of time by FQXI member Julian Barber at the University of Oxford.
Either time just does not exist, as in the point of view of Julian Barber, which comes from thinking about combining quantum mechanics and cosmology, or in Einstein's picture, the whole history of the universe is one, is the real reality, what we call the black universe, so that what's the really true picture is, if you will, a picture in which the whole history of the universe is presented as one, and our lives are trajectories which start somewhere in this block, go for some distance, then end. The geometrization of time is representing time as if it were another dimension of space.
One of the reasons Smolin is unsatisfied with the current thinking about time is that despite the enormous amounts of progress that have been made over the past 25 years in understanding quantum gravity, our understanding of time has been at a standstill.
This hypothesis that time as we experience it is not fundamental but a kind of emergent phenomenon hasn't been demonstrated very clearly by the theoretical models that were supposed to explicate it.
Another problem with the current thinking, according to Smolin, has to do with the laws of nature. These laws are outside time, yet they do influence how things change in time. A few very basic questions about these laws have never satisfactorily been answered.
One of them is, what chose the laws? It's not enough to say what the laws of nature are. If you really want an explanation, you have to give insight into why these are the laws rather than other laws. And the second question is, laws act on conditions at one time, so-called initial conditions, to predict conditions at a later time. But they can't therefore explain what the initial conditions were, and if the universe began at the Big Bang or soon after, what chose the initial conditions then? And as we've learned from cosmological observations and the conclusion of the last several decades of cosmological data, which is that the initial conditions of our universe were extraordinarily improbable and special, and that is unexplained and is not explainable in a paradigm in which the initial data are input, just like the choice of the laws is not explainable in a paradigm where the choice of the laws are input to the paradigm.
It is this inability to satisfactorily answer these very basic questions, despite all the decades of research in this area, that have helped change Smolin's mind about the unreality of time.
Reflecting on them, I came to the point of view that the only way to explain the choice of the laws and the initial conditions is if they're the result of evolution taking place in time. Let me emphasize a caveat to that. The only way to explain them in a way that's scientific, which means that by means of a hypothesis that's susceptible to investigation by further testing, is to assume that the laws are not absolute and fixed for all time, but do evolve and change in time like everything else. And investigating that idea, it became clear to me that if laws evolve in time rather than time emerge from law, then time has to be more fundamental than law, that time has to exist at a deeper level than even the laws of nature exist. And that's what led me to change my mind and think that time must be fundamental.
If the laws of nature are evolving over time, this has some interesting consequences which could make life and the future of our universe a lot less predictable than in the framework in which time is emergent.
I think the only reasonable context in which you can have a scientific explanation for the choice of the laws and initial conditions is if the Big Bang is not the beginning of time but is a transition, a process from an earlier era of the universe, so that our universe is much older than the 13.8 or so billion years that the observations have it to be. And in these earlier eras, I believe the laws were different, and that the laws have evolved over many eras to be what they are presently. And this, because the past leaves fossils and leaves evidence by which it can be examined, this is a testable hypothesis, and an early stage in my thinking about this was the development of a particular scenario for how laws might evolve through a succession of Big Bangs, which is called cosmological natural selection. That scenario or hypothesis did make several predictions which have been tested over the last 18 or so years since I published the idea. If the laws of nature can change, the question is whether there is a meta principle or a meta law which determines how they change. And that's a very key question. It may be that the future is partly not predictable or not determinable from the information that we can have about our universe.
But there is a major problem with the idea that time is real. Einstein's theories of special and general relativity suggest that time is relative, ticking differently for everything depending on their speed in relation to other objects. So how does Smolin marry his idea with Einstein's?
General relativity is not actually in contradiction with the idea that there is a real objective universal notion of time. The research which shows this compatibility is work the last several years called shape dynamics. The easiest way to describe it is that the ability to change what the definition of time is, which is apparently there in general relativity, is replaced by an ability to change the apparent sizes of objects. So relativity of time is replaced in this formulation by a relativity of size. And if you take away the size from our perception of the world, then you have left shape. So this is why this is called shape dynamics.
Just as people can differ in their perception of the order in which two events happen, which are simultaneous or very close in time, so can this apply to size. Of course, we all agree that a flower is smaller than a tree. But would it still be the case if the tree was somewhere else in the universe? We simply can't know, because by bringing a ruler to the tree or moving the flower to the tree's point in space, we can't be sure whether the transport or the universe itself will be affecting either the size of the ruler or the flower. So we cannot say with certainty that the flower is smaller than the tree at any point in the universe, much like Einstein suggested that the timing of events is relative. So is the size of things. But what does stay the same, even at different distances, different times and different places in space, is the shape of objects. In shape dynamics, time is like our proverbial river of time, with a constant flow that cannot be altered, much like we actually experience time in our daily lives. So Smolin claims that while in general relativity size is universal and time is relative, in shape dynamics time is universal and size is relative. In his new book, Smolin sets out a strong case for why he thinks time is real. If he's right, the consequences could be enormous.
I think that the issue of time is key to understanding quantum mechanics correctly, and that what's needed is not to interpret the mathematics of quantum mechanics as given, but to go beyond quantum mechanics and find a deeper theory which will make predictions which disagrees with the predictions of quantum mechanics. The way that we formulate it is we set out principles which we think cosmological theory should follow. And one of these principles is that there is only one universe. And we believe that this has to be imposed to keep cosmology scientific.
If, after experimentation of his ideas, it turns out that Smolin is right, it will turn our understanding of the universe upside down. The Big Bang may not have been the birthplace and time of our universe. Our universe could be a lot older than we suspect, and the laws that have governed it over time have possibly changed dramatically, and may be changing all the time. It is these changing laws and the unpredictability that follows from it that, for Smolin, make the universe a much more attractive place.
I think that living in a universe which is explicable by the process of science, but where the future is not totally predictable, gives us a sense of optimism. It means that determinism is false, that the impression that human beings have that we can invent novel ideas, novel games, novel solutions to the problems that face us, novel concepts, novel forms of art is real, that novelty is something that both nature can produce in its history and we can produce. And I think this makes the cosmology that is much more friendly to our aspirations for humankind.
That was Lee Smolin chatting with Karin Pikama.
If you visit the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find links to an article that describes Lee Smolin's ideas on the reality of time in more detail. You'll also find a link to the August 2012 podcast, which features an interview with Julian Barber talking about his ideas on shape dynamics. Now, Smolin's not the only FQXI grant winner to have been busy this month. Jorge Pullin at Louisiana State University and Rodolfo Gambini at the University of the Republic in Montevideo, Uruguay, have been examining black holes through the lens of loop quantum gravity, a theory that attempts to unite quantum mechanics and general relativity. According to Einstein's general theory of relativity, space-time is so warped at the centre of a black hole, it becomes infinitely curved, at a small point known as a singularity. Here, even the laws of physics break down. But in a new paper, appearing in the journal Physical Review Letters, Pullin and Gambini have shown that loop quantum gravity may be able to remove the singularity from the black hole's core entirely, as Pullin explained to me earlier.
So I'm Jorge Pullin from the Louisiana State University, and I normally work in general relativity, classical, and quantum.
you have been looking at a particular problem with black holes, and that's the singularity that lies at their core. Can you tell us a bit more about what the singularity is and why it's predicted to occur in general relativity?
So in general relativity, when one solves the equations of the theory for black holes in situations, say, with spherical symmetry, for instance, one discovers that inside the black hole, there's a place where all the quantities of the theory become sort of ill-defined. They become infinite. Many of them become infinite. And therefore, the theory loses predictive power. It means that there's something wrong. And the general expectation over many years had been that when one adds quantum physics to this, somehow the problem will be fixed. And similar concepts of this sort had also been applied at other kinds of singularities, like the singularity that happens at the Big Bang at the beginning of the universe. Now, a few years ago, loop quantum gravity was able to show that indeed for that particular singularity, the one at the beginning of the universe, indeed, adding the quantum treatment eliminated the singularity.
So, you know, you talked there about how people have been trying to combine quantum mechanics and gravity and come up with a theory of quantum gravity. And I think physicists have been struggling to do that for some time. And then there's this idea of loop quantum gravity that people have been applying to the Big Bang. Can you explain what loop quantum gravity is before you tell us how you applied it?
So loop quantum gravity is an attempt to apply the rules of quantum mechanics to general relativity by itself. And it uses a lot the geometric notions of general relativity. So space-time becomes quantum, and the fundamental excitations of space-time become one-dimensional in nature. That's what the loops are about.
So when you say that it becomes quantum mechanical in nature, when we talk about space-time, is that a sense in which there's some sort of fundamental building block of space-time, and that's this loop?
Yeah, the loop is like a fundamental block of space-time, is what endows space-time with geometry. So, for instance, if you envision a surface, like the surface of a table, that surface is pierced by an enormous amount of these little loops that the theory predicts, and each of them endows that table with an area. If there weren't loops there, it would be a very strange situation. You would have a table whose area would be zero. That sort of paradoxical things that occur when you look at these very quantum regimes of space-time that we're not normally accustomed to deal with in everyday life.
Okay, and so what's happened sort of in the past when physicists who are researching loop quantum gravity have applied it to try to think about what happened at the Big Bang, what's going on with the singularity that people believe occurred at the Big Bang?
Yeah, so a development that took place in the last decade was that people realized that the Big Bang was eliminated by loop quantum gravity and replaced by a bounce. So the universe, if one runs it back in time, one reaches the place where the Big Bang was supposed to be, and the universe is contracting because we're running it backwards. And what one finds is that the contraction stops at a certain point, and it re-expands again into a sort of precursor universe to the one we live in. And the Big Bang was replaced by a region of space-time that is very highly curved, but its curvature is not infinite. And what we have done now is obtain a similar result, but for the singularity inside black holes.
And so now you've taken sort of the mathematics of loop quantum gravity and those ideas and applied them to thinking about what happens inside a black hole. So tell us about what you did there.
So we were able to treat the problem with spherical symmetry. And what we discovered is something relatively similar to what happens in the Big Bang. As one plunges into the black hole, curvatures start to become large, but at some point one reaches a maximum value, and then curvatures start to decrease. And so one sort of could tunnel, in principle, into another region of space-time. Again, the singularity gets replaced by a region of very high curvature, so it wouldn't be possible for a human being to walk through there, say. You'll be ripped apart long before reaching that point by tidal forces. But in principle, when one thought of a very high energetic particle or something like that, it could make it through that region and sort of exit into another region of space-time.
And when it exits into another region of space-time, is it coming out into the inside of another black hole? Or is it coming out into normal space-time somewhere else? What exactly is happening?
So our model is an extremely simple-minded one that is not necessarily going to reflect what happens really in nature out there. And what really happens in nature, we don't really know for 100% for sure, because as we know, black holes eventually evaporate by Hawking radiation. and that has not been treated with loop quantum gravity. So I could speculate a little bit about what really happens in nature. What really happened in nature is that as you fall into the black hole starts to evaporate as well, and eventually the black hole disappears, and you just keep moving into the same universe you were in when the whole process started.
So it's like a sort of a never-ending tunnel.
Right.
Okay, and so, you know, why is this so interesting? Because I think, you know, people have been very excited about this idea of getting rid of this singularity. And, you know, why is that? Is it just because physicists don't like singularities because they don't know exactly what happens in this infinitely small area of space-time? Or are there some very important implications to do with why we need to get rid of singularities?
Well, to begin with, singularities are a place where your theory loses predictive power. I mean, you can't compute things that are infinite and so on and so forth. So there's something clearly wrong there that needs to be fixed. And the fact that combining general relativity with quantum mechanics seems to fix it is very attractive because it means that the combined theory is sort of better than the theory we had before. So I think that's one of the main reasons people were interested in this. And people tried for many years to try to do this, and they weren't successful with previous attempts to quantization that predated loop quantum gravity.
Thank you to Jorge Pullen for explaining his ideas to Zia.
There's an extended version of that interview on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. In it, Pullen explains how this work might help solve a paradox about what happens to information as a black hole evaporates.
Okay, so far we've learned that time can be cloaked.
That time is real, maybe.
And that time may have extended before the Big Bang. Whew, I think I get my head around that, as long as there's nothing more.
Brendan?
Yes?
We do have one more time-twisting tale to tell. But luckily, Brendan, I know you're a big fan of entanglement experiments.
Why, yes, I am. That's where you produce, let's say, two photons at the same time, and they become linked in a spooky way so that no matter how far apart you separate them, operations carried out on one photon always immediately influence the properties of its partner, as though they remain one particle.
Spookier still, in a paper in Physical Review Letters in May, a team of physicists at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Israel showed that you can entangle two photons that not only were not produced together in the lab, they don't even exist at the same time. Team member Hegai Eisenberg told me all about how to entangle photons from the future with those in the past.
My name is Hegai Eisenberg. I'm working at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Jerusalem. I'm a physics professor here, so I have my own research lab.
So one of the most famous counterintuitive aspects of quantum mechanics is this idea of entanglement. You know, this idea that has been shown in the lab many times that two quantum particles or two particles of light, photons as they're known as, can become intertwined in such a way that whenever you make a measurement on one, it influences the properties of another. Can you explain a bit more about what entanglement is in terms of photons?
Now, the essence of entanglement is that you have two subsystems of a quantum system, and there's no way that we can fully describe one and then fully describe the other and still get a full description of the system. And the result of this inseparability of entangled states is what led to the original so-called paradox, that you measure the first particle and something is changing on the second particle instantaneously. But what is changing, actually, it's a very delicate, and you have to be careful when you say that something is changing on the other particle. What you should actually say, this is how I explain it to my students, I say, our physical description of the other particle is changed. It's only the way we understand the other particle. But there's no real measurement that we can do to see a real effect on the other particle. So nevertheless, Einstein called it spooky action at a distance because he thought that it's already affecting the other particle too much and it violates causality. This was his original claim.
But usually when we talk about that, we talk about two particles being created at the same time so that they're prepared together and they kind of share this bond, this entanglement from birth. But now in your new experiment, you managed to entangle two photons that don't even exist at the same time. Can you explain what you did in your experiment?
I would even emphasize that Einstein even thought that the two particles have to interact in order to be entangled. And by checking what he said, the spooky action at a distance, I emphasize the word distance. Now, it's already known that the two particles don't have actually to interact, and this is a protocol called quantum entanglement swapping. In this protocol, and we are still not talking about separation in time, just in separation in space, you take two pairs of entangled particles, and let's name them. The first pair we will call particles 1 and 2, and the second pair will be called particles 3 and 4, and there is an entanglement connection between particles 1 and 2, and individually separated between the pair 3 and 4. But there's no connection between any of the first pair to the second pair. Now, what entanglement swapping is doing is taking one photon from each of the pairs, so let's say photons 2 and 3, and making what is called a projection measurement. The meaning is that the result of this measurement shows in which way particle 2 and 3 can be entangled, and actually the measurement is entangling them. And the result is that we took two uncorrelated photons, photons 2 and 3, and we entangled them by this measurement, by this projection. And the result is that photons 1 and 4 that never met each other, only photons 2 and 3 have to meet in this protocol, photons 1 and 4 become entangled. This is what is called entanglement swapping. Now, we took this experiment and just shifted a little bit the order of the events, and this was enough. We only created photons 1 and 2 at the beginning, and then we right away measure photon number 1. So photon 2 is left, it still has some quantum connection to photon number 1, so we keep photon number 2, and only then, after the measurement of photon number 1, we create the second pair of photons 3 and 4. We take photon 3, project it together with photon 2, and get the entanglement connection of photons 4 and 1. But this time, photon 4 that is here in the lab is entangled with photon number 1 that was already measured before photon 4 was created. So these quantum correlations are more complicated than just a classical story of a grandfather giving birth to a father that gives birth to a son, and the generations continue. It's more than that, because we really show this entanglement and separability criterion between photons 1 and 4.
What is the most exciting thing about this in terms of our understanding of fundamental physics?
What our experiment is doing is actually intrigue people to think a little bit more about what is entanglement and what are we really saying when we are saying separated systems. So separated systems is not just spatially separated, it's also temporally separated. Now, when you take Einstein's word about spooky action at a distance, about us measuring one particle and affecting the physical description of the other one, and you rephrase it in our experiment, then you get really spooky things, I would say. But what it means when you take Einstein's word and put them into our experiments is that when you measure the particle 1, and the moment you do that, you change the physical description of a particle that wasn't even created yet. So who knows whether you are going to entangle it or not. But nevertheless, if the protocol is running, by measuring particle 1, you changed the physical description of a particle that wasn't even created yet. And when you go the other way, you say, what happens when I measure the last particle? Then you say, okay, my physical description, the way I describe nature, the way I describe particle 1 has to change now, but particle 1 doesn't exist anymore. It's just the way I interpret the results that's changed. This is why we can only observe these quantum correlations a posteriori, at the end of the experiment. In no stage in the middle of the experiment, we are able to declare any of the results. These results only exist after all the clicks in the detectors, all the experiment was finished. And then, retrospectively, we say, okay, there were quantum correlations. And this is actually also the reason why you cannot, for example, communicate with the past, send information to the past, affect the past, and vice versa to the future. So this is why this experiment, I and you, I guess, because that's why you contacted me, find it interesting.
That was Haggai Eisenberg talking to Zia.
You'll also find an extended version of that interview on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, in which Eisenberg describes some of his work in more technical detail and also talks about its possible practical applications in terms of secure communication.
Also, thank you to @FinnOger, that's @FinnOger on Twitter, for pointing out the coincidence that H. Eisenberg is spookily close to Heisenberg.
Werner Heisenberg, one of the founders of quantum mechanics, was clearly entangled with Haggai Eisenberg before he existed too. But you can, of course, follow us on Twitter @FQXI and email us at podcast@fqxi.org.
That's all for this edition. So thank you again to Joseph Lukens, Lee Smolin, Karin Pikama, and Jorge Pullen.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.